Welcome to the Discotech Podcast. We're glad you're joining us. Let me introduce everyone. I'm Marcy, Marcy Lundinard on Twitter. And today we have Lewis Shimatrek on Twitter. Hi, Lewis.
Hello.
And Rachel Dramadork884 on Twitter. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
And today we're excited to have a special guest with us, Ryan Britt. He is the author of Luke Skywalker Can't Read and Other Geeky Truths, and an upcoming book, Phasers on Stun, How the Making and Remaking of Star Trek Changed the World. He's also a contributor to StarTrek.com, Den of Geek, and has written for Vice, The Daily Beast, and The New York Times. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks, Marcy.
Rachel's going to start us off tonight.
So writing about Star Trek and all manner of geeky things sounds like a dream job. How did this all come about?
Oh, wow. Just hit me with the hard questions right away. first of all, I just want to say thanks for having me on. And I follow you all on Twitter, and it just brings me a lot of joy because somebody was saying to me the other day about how awful Twitter is. And I feel like that's true often. But then I was like, but you're not on Star Trek Twitter, which is very pure and wonderful. To answer that question, I also write for Inverse very, very frequently. To answer that question, the short answer is that I got into writing nonfiction because I realized it was a lot easier to do than fiction. So like in 2010, I'll do the very short version of this, but it is a good question. In 2010, I was selling personal essays to a website that doesn't exist anymore called nerve.com. I don't know if anybody remembers that. It was like a sex and culture website. And I was doing like kind of like dating story stuff for them. And how I got into that is like kind of uninteresting. I just like submitted a dating story idea and they bought it. So like that, not interesting. But they were doing some more pop culture stuff, and they were like, do you want to do something about how Doctor Who is sexy? Because, you know, it was 2009, 2010, and Doctor Who was big. So I wrote something about that, about Doctor Who, and it reminded me of how much I liked writing about science fiction, and I was trying to write science fiction unsuccessfully. So then I discovered that the magazine Clark's World, which is a science fiction publication, paid the same for nonfiction that they did for fiction. So I pitched them an essay about literary crossovers in science fiction. And I interviewed a bunch of like writers that I knew in New York who were like book writers. And they bought that essay. And then I wrote an essay about Sherlock Holmes. And they bought that and like how Sherlock Holmes was sci-fi. And then after that, there was an opening to be a part-time blogger at a website called Tor.com, which I don't know if you folks are familiar with, is a science fiction publisher that has a blog. And I just started doing social media and stuff for them. And within a year, I was just kind of writing a bunch of blogs about sci-fi and Star Trek. And that was around 2011. And then from there, I had a resume. And so from that point, I wrote a bunch of essays about Star Trek and Star Wars. And then I was able to parlay that into a book proposal that took forever to sell. And then from that, I just sort of like, the resume just built over time. And then eventually I got a staff writing job at Inverse in 2016. And then in 2017, Star Trek Discovery came out. And interestingly enough, I was one of the journalists that was really bothering CBS a lot. and the famous story is that, and this is in my book that comes out in May of next year, is that they weren't giving a lot of screeners out for the, I don't know if you remember this, but they didn't give screeners out to anyone. This was like a news story. It was like a public news story that CBS withheld the first two episodes, Battle of the Binary Stars and Vulcan Hello.
Oh yeah, because I remember people were like, why aren't reviews coming out? And they're like, we can't review it.
It was not screened for press. And my theory at the time was correct. It was because they were hiding the death of Giorgio in the second episode. After that, I was writing a bunch of fan theory articles for Inverse about how Lorca was from the Mirror Universe. And of course, I was not the only person that was saying this, right? Like, I was not the only person that was saying this. As far as I know, I am the only person that got a phone call from CBS publicity telling me to stop. because our articles were doing really well. And this is something else I always say to people who are like, haters, like people that don't like Disco or Picard or Lower Decks or whatever, are like, the new shows aren't popular. I was like, they are. There's just not always people commenting on articles. Like the articles I've written about new Star Trek since 2017 are heavily trafficked. Like hundreds and hundreds and thousands of views, millions of views of, and particularly that first season with the Mirror Universe stuff. Anyway, CBS was like, hey, like, please, can you walk back some of this stuff? Because it's like, it really is the big reveal. And I was like, yes, but you have to give me access. You have to give me screeners and you have to give me interviews. They're like, no problem. You want to talk to Rainn Wilson next week? And that was kind of the origin story of me covering Trek more hardcore than just being like a critic, right? Like doing it like journalism. And so from there, it was just, it's been really great. I've been lucky enough to do that both at Inverse and Sci-Fi Wire and Den of Geek. But yeah, you know.
That's really cool.
I don't love doing that origin story, but yeah, it's like, it's not, I didn't have, there was nothing special. There was nothing special other than just like bothering people a lot. And like working in the industry for a long time.
Mm-hmm. All right, sometimes you gotta bother people.
You gotta bother people sometimes. And even now, sometimes, like, I love them so dearly. Like, again, the people that work at CBS and Paramount Plus are great, great, great people. And they work really, really hard. And yeah, you know, like, just the life of an entertainment journalist is that you'll, I remember like when Arium died in Disco season 2. I was like emailing my CBS rep, like as I was watching the screener to interview Hannah, Hannah Chessman, who played Arium in season 2. And they're like, yeah, we already know that you're going to want this phoner. You're like, they're like, we saw this coming a mile away. But yeah, like I asked for like Melissa George, you know, in Disco season 2, who played Vina.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I don't think that anybody else interviewed her that in America. Like I could not find any other. Like I dug and dug and I was like, I feel like just nobody asked for it. You know, like I'm like, I don't know. We can talk about Lower Decks. Like Alice Krieg is of course in the new Lower Decks is the Borg Queen. Mm-hmm. And so she only has like 3 lines, but I was like, I asked them this week. I was like, I'd love to talk to Alice. I know that she's only has a small, and they're like, maybe, you know? And so again, like I might be able to talk to her over the weekend. We'll see, but I'll definitely shoot you guys the link if I do, but
yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And sometimes they're just like, oh yeah, you can talk to this person right now or you know. But yeah, it's, you know, it's a lot of, I also just writing a book about Star Trek. It was like a lot of talking to people on the phone and seeing if they're really going to talk to you. And then last minute they really are. And then, yeah, it's not an easy way to, it's a dream job. Yes. But it's not an easy way to make a living because sometimes, I mean, a small example is I'm unrelated to Trek is I'm interviewing Jeffrey Wright tomorrow for the new Bond film. And they cool. almost, and they, right. I love Jeffrey Wright. I loved him. I love him in Westworld. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's just like I used to wait on him in Brooklyn at a bar that doesn't exist anymore. And he was just such a lovely man. But yeah, it was for a different publication. And they were almost going to change the time of the interview that I couldn't do it. And I had to be like, no, I can do it. I can do it. So yeah, sometimes you have to be super flexible, which is hard when you have a life, as you all do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just out of curiosity, are you going to tell Jeffrey Wright that you used to bartend for him?
Or I will. I certainly will because he was really nice and he once fist bumped me in Union Square Park in New York City, like years later, wordlessly while talking on a cell phone, walked by me and I was just like, that was the coolest thing.
That is that's cool. Nice.
One of the coolest things that's ever happened to me. I mean, I don't know.
Very nice.
It's up there. So Sonequa Martin Green, interviewing Sonequa Martin Green, maybe top all of it, to be honest.
She seems so cool. Lovely. Everybody who works with her says she's absolutely lovely. Mm-hmm.
My daughter has a gender neutral name, Randall. And so I told Sonequa this in 2019 for the Disco season 2 finale. And I was just like, Michael Burnham is so amazing because I have a kid with a girl with a kind of a boy's name. And she was just like, God bless her. God bless Randall. And I was like, yes, Michael Burnham just blessed my child.
That's really sweet. Yes.
But yeah, really nice. I talking to Sonequa, I think that's probably in terms of Trek folks I've talked to, it's up there.
That's great. Lewis, you had a question?
Yes. We have enjoyed your articles about the Easter egg this season in Lower Decks. There have been so many references this season. How did you go about finding them and backgrounds for all of them?
Oh, man. well, I generally watch all the new shows like 3 times.
Oh.
And so then I'll just go through and I'll write a list down of something that seems like that it reminded me of something. And then I'll double check it either in books or on Memory Alpha or sometimes actually going in the episode that they're referencing and seeing if I'm right about the reference. But yeah, I mean, I think it just comes from a deep love of Easter egg lists are hard. And actually at Den of Geek, they put a pause on them because they're very time consuming and they don't get as much traffic as other articles. I'm like revealing all these industry secrets on this podcast. Like somebody's going to come like find me from Section 31 and just join me for like revealing all these things. I don't know why. It's so fun to talk on a podcast. It's like, oh, I could just say anything. But yeah, like also StarTrek.com started doing Easter egg articles that were kind of similar. And so we were like, oh, you know, the exclusivity sort of feels, Mike McMahon is like explaining the Easter eggs. You feel kind of dumb to having done the same thing 2 days prior. So now I'm just doing like focusing on specific ones. But I don't know, Lewis, like to answer your question, I guess that like I have been watching Star Trek since I was 6.
Yeah.
And I think that some of it is just like, I'll see like an object or a line and I'll be like, that's something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just like making a list. And sometimes I won't, there'll be something that I won't mention just because it's like, I'm not sure how deep I can go into it. But yeah, like this episode, for example, like I Excretus, this Lower Decks episode that just aired, mm-hmm. I had to double check that I was right about it being Ron Jones, who was the composer of the music for The Best of Both Worlds. Because, you know, I don't necessarily know that there's a lot of composers on The Next Generation, but I knew that music when Boimler is like fighting off the Borg was really familiar, yeah. You know? And like, I interviewed Chris Westlake, who's the composer of Lower Decks for season 1. And I know that he's obsessed with putting musical Easter eggs in, you know, in what was the movie episode? Crisis Point, when Mariner makes the movie.
Yes.
Like Chris Westlake, the composer for Lower Decks, just like put in so many musical Easter eggs to Star Trek scores, like James Horner's like French horns and all sorts of nutty stuff.
I feel so bad because I feel like I didn't realize until you were saying this that they did that. I think the only one that I really picked up was the Voyager theme, which was really in your face in the episode with Tom Paris.
Oh, when Boimler's like singing it?
Yes.
I mean, I love that. So, well, because he sings the TNG theme in season 1 too. He whistles the TNG theme to himself while.
I hope the show lasts long enough that, like, once a season, he'll sing one of the theme songs.
I feel like somebody has to sing Faith in the Heart, right? Like, yes. It just feels like it almost happened with Riker. Anyway, but yeah, I guess that, like, some of it is like where with the Best of Both Worlds Sonic Easter egg, I almost didn't know, Lewis. Like, I was like, am I right about that? And so then I like checked and I listened to the scene in the episode. I was like, yep, that's what that is.
That's a good catch.
That's a really good catch. What do you think about the way Lower Decks has changed since it first aired last summer? They've made some subtle changes along the way.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be curious to hear what you folks think. I feel like it's gotten even more, for lack of a better word, like even more into its Trekkiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Oh, I would definitely agree.
Like, I feel like when I remember talking to a friend when season 1 came out and they were sort of on the fence about it. And I said to them, look, it's like each episode is like commenting on something about Star Trek, but in like 4 different ways. You know, mm-hmm. like in the season premiere of this season, you know, it's like the God episode, right? So like Ransom turns into the Gary Mitchell God. And so mm-hmm. they're commenting on like playing God, but like in all these other ways, right? Because it's the literal Gary Mitchell thing, but then it's also Tendi playing God because she's like manipulating medical ethics to try to like fix Rutherford or whatever. So mm-hmm. she's like playing God, but then also like Mariner is also like acting like as her own authority, and like Mariner is like a sort of like law unto herself or whatever. So I feel like that every Lower Decks this season feels hyper aware of each of those themes, right? Of like, and so like in this new one, like the idea of experience, like what, like does your experience like mean that you're owed certain things that other people aren't? And the episode doesn't really come out with a clear answer, right? Because the crew of the Cerritos certainly has more experience than Sherry, right? The drill instructor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then like, if you flip it a little bit, you're also like, well, the Lower Deckers experience like being less than that of the bridge crew, like still doesn't really justify them getting a crap replicator. You know, so I feel like it just has one theme and then it does it like 4 times. And I feel like with this season, they really refined that. But But I also feel like they've just embraced some of the, that the show is for fans. It feels like the show is not trying to, it feels like it's just for fans. Like if you're a cat, if this is your first Star Trek, I think that that's great. But I feel like that if you are a fan and you're like somehow not watching it, it's just so sad.
That's true. I do have a friend where she married into like someone who's a Star Trek fan, and what she's watched is like a little bit of Discovery and all of Lower Decks, and she loves Lower Decks. And I genuinely had to ask her, "Do you get the jokes?" Like, and she's like, "My husband explains." I was like, "Okay, like that's." I was like, "I love it. I don't. I would never be the show that I would like say like start with this."
But there are some jokes that are like such deep cuts that I think are communicated just through enunciation. Like I think it's in season one in the courtroom. I think it's in Veritas in the courtroom episode where they're debating about who was a bigger badass, like Khan or Roga Daynar. And Boimler goes, "Roga Daynar was a bigger badass." And it's like, okay, that is a really deep cut. Even I had to be like, wait a minute, that's a TNG episode. He's some kind of terrorist. And the joke works, and it's funny because of the way that Jack Quaid delivers it, I think. Because you know that Roga Daynar sounds like a silly character.
Yeah.
So the fact that in the way that, what I love about that scene is the way that Jack Quaid goes, he's so confident that Roga Daynar is a bigger badass than Khan. He doesn't say, "Oh my God, Ronan Rayar is so much better than Khan." He goes, "It's obviously Roga Daynar." Like, and so I think that kind of humor, that those kinds of decisions from the whole voice cast, Tawny Newsome and Eugene Carrero and Noel Wells, are just like, they make these really smart humor decisions that you might not know why it's like again, I had to remember who Roga Daynar was, but I still laughed so hard at that joke because I knew whatever Boimler was referencing was not as cool as Khan.
It wasn't Khan level.
It wasn't Khan level. So I think that, but they, I don't know, that to me is sometimes maybe that's the way the humor works, is just you can see the juxtaposition, right? Of two things.
We were saying on our last podcast about Lower Decks, it just feels like there's more references to start, like previous shows than there were in the first season. And like it's gone deeper.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I will say there are perhaps more than you realize in the first season. I think that the plots of this season are more referential. And I don't think that the plots of the previous, like the actual storylines of the previous season, I think were probably less referential. But there were still a lot of like, you know, that joke I just referenced, that episode, Veritas, is like, I mean, Ken Mitchell from Discovery plays two different characters in that. There's a Gorn wedding in that episode. They steal a bird of prey. You know, Rutherford does a fan dance referencing Star Trek V. Yeah. You know, like there's but yeah, I have felt that, I know what you mean. I feel like this season is embraces the deep cuts more. Yeah, even like the Borg babies thing, like I was like, that is so, like they did not have to include Borg babies in like Boimler rescuing Borg babies.
Yeah, when he pulled them out, I always forget. I was like, "Oh yeah, there are babies. It's weird that there are babies."
Right, but I wrote this like 1,000 word screed on this, but like I feel like that was so brilliant because of course the test will give you a slightly higher score if you rescue the innocent Borg babies, because someone at Starfleet was like, "It's super unethical that we're blowing up these Borg ships that have Borg babies on them." Mm-hmm. And so like by the time of Lower Decks, which is like post First Contact, post Voyager returning, post Seven of Nine, like coming to the Alpha Quadrant, it's cool because then you get to be like, right, that someone who's Boimler's age and experience, right? Because 2381 is like, it's after all of that. It's after DS9, it's after Voyager, it's after all the TNG films, you know? So all of the mistakes that those crews would have made, you know, like not giving a shit about Borg babies, you know, have been probably internalized. Anyway, that's my headcanon for it, right? Like that Starfleet is like, it is like the ideal Borg situation is to liberate them as much as possible and teach the Borg Queen empathy, right? So like, that's what happens, right? He has 100% score because he taught the Borg Queen, because that is real. 100% Starfleet would be teaching the Borg Queen empathy and rescuing Borg babies, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I feel like that Mike McMahon, like, he said so many times, not just to me, but to many journalists, that like the show is a Rosetta Stone for all of Star Trek, and that the show is a big fan of Star, like all the characters live in Star Trek. And so they love these things, even if these things are not the best things about Star Trek, you know, which is why I think that, where they like prank called Armus, I thought was like brilliant, you know, because it's like, right. Like Armus is still there in canon, you know, and is awful. So, but there's nothing they can, but we just left him on that planet. Like they, you know, Starfleet would never go and blow him up because that would be unethical, right? Even though he killed Tasha. So like, how does Starfleet get back at Armus? It's like, oh, they prank call him.
I love the prank call so much.
So Lower Decks is pretty far off the beaten path for this franchise. What surprised you most about the show?
I think that what surprised me most about the show was actually of how much, in both seasons, but particularly this season, about how much it isn't trying to cater to someone who doesn't understand Star Trek. That it's actually a great way for someone to understand Star Trek if they've never seen it. But that I think that a lot of the new shows, and I love the new shows, and I almost never say anything bad about the new shows, and I'm not going to. But I do think that the new shows have a tendency, particularly with Disco season one, I think, and I think a bit with Picard season one, to try to sort of go away from a familiar Star Trek path to maybe reach a more mainstream audience, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that like a good example of this is like, I love Picard season one. I love Michael Chabon. I've interviewed him many times. I was a huge fan of his novels. He's a writing hero of mine. Love Picard season one. I don't know if we needed Dodge to die in the first episode of Picard season one. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm still sad about that.
You know, but I think that was like, that felt like one of these like prestige TV show mystery box things. And I feel like Lower Decks doesn't do that. Like you know, Boimler has that speech in the second episode of this season about like what Starfleet means to him, right? And I think that is the thing that surprises me the most about the show, is that it makes comment on Star Trek itself, and it makes comment on the new shows. I mean, it makes comment on like the action adventure problem that Star Trek has as a television franchise, that it always has to have like action and space battles and stuff to like sort of bring in, you know, people that aren't down with the space diplomacy. But Lower Decks sort of like makes fun of that a little bit, and also embraces, you know, their mission is second contact, right? Like, so that inherently means that like it's embracing the sort of more nerdy bureaucracy of the franchise.
We have so many great looking Star Trek shows coming out so far. We were so excited on Star Trek Day. Have you seen any of the upcoming seasons?
Oh, no.
Okay. So it's not that far ahead. I mean,
no, they don't do that far ahead. The furthest I ever got ahead is, I feel like I got the Disco season two like a couple weeks ahead. They don't do that far ahead. No, they're not ready, I don't think. I mean, I'm going to be doing some interviews with Prodigy and Discovery season four next weekend, and I have not seen any of Prodigy or Discovery season four.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know if I will ahead of time, but no, I know what you know about Strange New Worlds. and I know what you know about Discovery season four, and that may change in the next month, I would say that it's similar to films, right? Like when a film is coming out, like a Marvel film or a Star Wars film, where people who are journalists tend to see it maybe 2 weeks before, maybe a week, but that's kind of it. You know what I mean? Like it's usually not much. Like it's weird now because of COVID, you know, because there's these movies that have been in development for like a year that weren't released, like Dune or the new James Bond movie or whatever. So that's weird. But generally speaking, someone who's a journalist on my level, you know, I don't write for the New York Times, you know. One thing I left out of my origin story, Rachel, was that one of the first things that I covered as a freelancer was Doctor Who, because in 2010, when Matt Smith took over, and I went to like the press screening in the East Village and met Matt Smith.
Oh, cool.
Who is a very attractive man. he is a very attractive man. And this was, 2010. But yeah, like that was even like, I think that was like even like 4 days before it came out. You know okay. what I mean? Like, it's pretty close. Like they did like Disco Season 2, like New York red carpet, I feel like 3 weeks before that came out. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to films.
So they give you a chance to write, but you still have to write fast.
Yeah, it's not. And sometimes it's real down to the wire, like particularly with finales, mm-hmm. like with Picard, I think it was the day before,
oof.
You know?
Yeah.
But again, like you always know when they're going to hide a spoiler because they're like holding off on the screener. But I also know with some shows, like I used to cover The Expanse, it would also be like the VFX would be like right down to the wire, mm-hmm. and sometimes it wouldn't even be that.
Oh, so out of curiosity, have you ever gone to screener where they're like, by the way, the effects aren't done?
Oh, all the time. It's very common. Okay. Not with Star Trek. Never with Star Trek.
Oh, really?
I mean, there's always a, my wife and I were watching like Ted Lasso screeners, and there will be like a scene where someone is looking at a television, but then they haven't added in what's going to be on the television yet.
Okay.
So there's just like an X on it. There's like a piece of tape, and you'll be like, why is there a piece of tape on that TV that Jason Sudeikis is looking at? I was like, oh, I'm watching a screener. Uh-huh. I would say that if any of you like work in book publishing, I'd say going to watching TV screeners is very similar to like getting an advanced reader's copy of a book.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's close to being done, but you might find a typo.
Yeah. That makes sense.
You know, but with CBS and Paramount, honestly, like they're really, I've never once like later watched the episode on my actual Paramount Plus subscription, be like, wow, that looked different. It's always, it always looks amazing.
Okay.
And I remember feeling that about Disco Season 1, like with like Ripper and stuff like that. Like it was like so cool. I'm like you, like I buy all the DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff, I watched Lower Decks Season 1 on Blu-ray a couple months ago on like a projector in my downstairs in my house, and I was like, oh, this looks so good.
I was curious, who is your favorite Lower Decks character, and has it changed this season?
I think that in Season 1 it was Mariner. I felt like Mariner was that like a version of me in my like late 20s, early 30s, who was like, party! And I remember interviewing Tawny Newsom and telling her this during Season 1, and like saying that she was like this like younger Captain Kirk, but not a male, and just, I don't know. I think I really like Mariner in Season 1. And I think that in Season 2, I've weirdly have shifted slightly towards Boimler, just because I found myself sort of feeling, I felt like I didn't feel as bad for Boimler in Season 1 for some reason. I don't know why. I actually feel like both Mariner and Boimler have slightly more character development in this season than they did in Season 1. I don't know. I just think that there's something about, I think that the Titan thing was really smart of like having him. I think that what I like about all of them is that they actually are really capable and really good at what they do. But Jack Quaid said this amazing thing where I was talking to Tawny Newsom about whether or not the Lower Deckers are heroes. And she was kind of like, no, they are people that go to their job and do their job. They are normal people. And Jack Quaid was like, but Mariner is Boimler's hero. And I kind of liked that, because I realized that I didn't necessarily identify with Mariner, but I thought that Mariner was amazing. I actually realized in this season I identify with Boimler more. He's the biggest fan, right? Like, and I think that like the Tom Paris episode, like transporter duplicate episode, I mean, he's just really good. So that would be my answer. But I actually love Tendi as well, because I feel like I know many Tendis in my life.
We didn't get quite as much Rutherford this season.
Yeah, and he's so great too. Well, I don't know. There's you may still. There's a few more episodes left.
So we kind of talked about it earlier with the music, but what was the hardest, most obscure Easter egg you found this season?
Oh, I should have like thought about this. I don't know. I mean, this would be like, there are people on Twitter that I feel like are actually oddly better at this. I just feel like that I just end up writing like the what it, I guess I'm more interested in like the what it means, right, than rather than just the existence of the Easter egg. Like that to me is always the thing that, that's my thing about writing about Trek or any sci-fi, is that it's not just like, I noticed this, you know, that the meme of Leonardo DiCaprio pointing right at the screen where he noticed something. I feel like that, like that's the beginning. Mm-hmm. And what I do and what I like about finding the thing is to be like, but what does that mean? I I guess that I really liked, it wasn't obscure, it was very obvious, but I liked the Kirk and Spock's names carved in the bar, because you had to then think about when that would have been. And so that was the thing I liked the most. I did a deep dive on Den of Geek of talking about when that conceivably would have been. At what point would Kirk and Spock have not been let into a fancy Starfleet party? When was that during the 5-year mission? And so then that's a lot of fun stuff, because then you do have to talk about the different years of the 5-year mission, right? So then it's like, okay, it's 2265 to 2270, but the only canonical episode that takes place in 2265 is Where No Man Has Gone Before, and everything else is a year later. So the argument could be that it could be early, right? It could be like right after Gary Mitchell, and that Kirk is actually drinking because Gary Mitchell has died. And that was his best friend. And Lower Decks loves referencing Gary Mitchell. So it feels like Mariner mentions Gary Mitchell in the first episode of Lower Decks. when she's like listing off Star Trek people, she's like, you know who Gary Mitchell is? They love talking about Gary Mitchell. So I liked that, because I liked thinking about the idea. I love that it's just like this cute moment in the episode, right? Where they're just like, oh, Kirk and Spock drank here. But then you have to really be like, right, but Kirk and Spock were like famous even during the 5-year mission. Like post Kirk, like taking up the doomsday machine, there's no way that he was getting kicked out of that party, right? Like post Errand of Mercy, where they stopped the Klingon War, there's no way they're getting kicked out of that party, because they are like the guys who stopped the Klingon War, or they're the crew that stopped the doomsday machine, you know? So I feel like that you then had to think about when it happened. And that's really cool, because then you're like, okay, was it around, Miri, or was it around right after Where No Man Has Gone Before? Was it, you know, so I like thinking about that, because I think that stuff's really, really fun to like dive into those missing parts. Mm-hmm. So that to me is an Easter egg that was an obvious Easter egg, but the implications were less obvious. Mm-hmm. And very smart, because it all works. You know, I think that that's the great thing about Lower Decks, is that it all works. It's not like, I think that a sort of hater would be like, that makes no sense. Kirk and Spock would always be admitted to Starfleet parties because Kirk and Spock were always awesome. And it's like, no, Kirk was a really young captain. He might've been very unpopular. And I think that, so to answer your question in like a roundabout way, in the Den of Geek article, I actually then went to some sort of non-canon stuff, like the Vonda McIntyre novel, Enterprise, the First Adventure. Vonda McIntyre is this amazing science fiction writer who wrote all these Star Trek novels. Have any of you read any Vonda McIntyre books? I'm sure you have. Rachel, I feel like I saw you tweet about one.
I actually haven't read that many Star Trek novels, so I feel like probably...
So Vonda McIntyre invented Sulu's first name, right? Like she invented Hikara, right, for the entropy effect, which was a Star Trek novel. Vonda McIntyre is like this amazing science fiction novelist who influenced all the Star Trek canon. And she wrote this book called Enterprise, the First Adventure. And it is like, it's like an attempt to fix the, you know, the discontinuity between the cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before and the rest of the show. And like, where was Chekhov? And he was there. He just worked on the Lower Decks, you know, but everyone hates Kirk in that novel. They hate him because he's like this young captain who like doesn't deserve what he's getting. And I thought that, you know, I'm not saying Lower Decks was referencing that novel specifically, but I am sure the writers have read it, you know? And so I just think that there's stuff like that, that just like little layers that are like that, that I think are really good. But yeah, I mean, I think I feel like the obvious ones are sometimes, what was the hardest one? I guess I didn't really answer your question. Come back to me. Let me think about that.
I feel like the next thing we want to ask is the answer we got, because it was...
I want to ask him, what was your favorite Easter egg?
Yeah.
Well, I guess that my favorite Easter egg right now, just because it's the episode that we just watched,
right,
was the Ron Jones music from Best of Both Worlds, mm-hmm. that I already mentioned. So I think that would probably be it. But I guess my favorite one was probably the giant Spock 2 skeleton, perhaps.
Yeah.
I think that one was like, because I really had to be like, is that, there's no other giant person that could be. You
that
know?
Episode made me watch the animated series, so I binged it in 3 days.
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. Oh, you know what I loved in that episode as well was Data's painting of Spot, the Picasso-esque painting that Data did of Spot. It's like in the hallway of the collector's ship in that episode.
I still don't think I've seen all the Easter eggs in that episode.
I need to watch it again.
I don't know if anyone have. Oh, you know what? You know what the other one is from that episode? Just thinking, I'm going through my list again, is when Boimler lists off all the things that Riker used to do on the Enterprise D, and one of them is acting in plays.
Mm-hmm.
I love that, because I love that that's my favorite, because Dr. Crusher is the author of a play called Something for Breakfast. Like, that is the name of that's in an episode of The Next Generation where she is always casting people in plays. And I just, like, as somebody who used to write plays, I just love that exists in Star Trek canon, that, like, mm-hmm. Dr. Crusher was really in, like, she casts Barclay as Cyrano, you know, in the Nth Degree, you know, like, that was a really good one. Just like that really quick aside. They talk about the string quartets, like all of that stuff, all that kind of like, and then you're like, oh yeah, which episodes were there string quartets in? And it's like, it's a lot. But I think that Sarek was the first one of the episode Sarek, I believe, mm-hmm. just because, like, when they're watching the string quartet, Sarek is crying, you know? So, but yeah, I don't know, that was we could go all day with some of those. I mean, like in the newest episode, when Mariner calls the Old West, you know, Cowboy Planet, a Starfleet classic. I thought that was a great Easter egg, because it doesn't just reference Spectre of the Gun, it references A Fistful of Data's, but it also references the Enterprise episode North Star.
Yes.
Which is actually the best, in my opinion, of those Western episodes. But what I like about that is, of all of those, North Star would be chronologically the oldest mission, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, because that's from the 22nd century. So Mariner saying the Cowboy Planet is a Starfleet classic, like, encompasses all of that, but it also is like, she is deeply aware of Archer as well.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for joining us to talk about Lower Decks. We've really enjoyed season 2 so far, and it's been fun chatting with other Star Trek fans about it along the way. And we always say that Lower Decks is a love letter to fans, and all these little references and Easter eggs you're finding of previous Treks are like the nuggets that are left for us to find and enjoy. And your articles are amazing resources, and we just want to thank you for those and let you know how much we enjoy them.
Thanks for inviting me, Marcy, and Rachel and Lewis. Thanks for having an amazing podcast and being so fun and wonderful people.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Had a great time talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.